Data breach news no longer seems shocking to us. We've become desensitized to it over the years. But if your organization has ever had a data breach affect its operations, or its customer data, or require a ransom payment, you know it's not an event that is easily forgotten. Today on the Journal of Accountancy podcast, cybersecurity expert Mike Foster offers tips for organizations to better understand and combat the common practices of hackers. But first, take a moment to listen to a word from our sponsor.
KPMG is committed to continuously identifying and implementing innovative approaches and tools to help deliver and enhance a quality audit. KPMG Audit, dedicated to trust, committed to quality. Visit audit.kpmg.us to learn more.
I'm Neil Amato, a senior editor with the J of A, and I'm going to start off with a question for Mike to answer based on his reference in presentations to the tale of the three little pigs. Mike, how can organizations build with bricks instead of with straw or sticks?
The most important items that need to be addressed, number one, is called application control. And very few companies actually use this. The technical term, the buzzword, is application whitelisting. You may have heard of a situation where Mary wants to send Tom email messages, but Tom doesn't ever get the email messages until someone goes in and whitelists Mary's email address to say it's okay to get email from Mary. Now, Tom gets all her emails because she got whitelisted. Her email address was approved by Tom's network. So that would be email whitelisting. Application whitelisting has nothing to do with that. And I just want to differentiate so people understand there is a difference. Application whitelisting, you get to specify, your IT department with your guidance will specify what programs are essential for business. And I use that word essential on purpose. So essential may be whatever you use for word processor, whatever you use for a spreadsheet, whatever program is particular to your industry, maybe an ERP, anything that is on your system that it's okay for users to use. List those applications, those programs, those apps as being okay to run. And Microsoft has a free tool to do that. It's built in as long as you have the business version of Windows called Windows Enterprise. There's a free tool included with that. I say it's free. You're buying Windows, so you're paying for it that way. But that program is called App Locker, APP Locker. And it'll help your IT professionals turn on this protection. Now, if a virus tries to get to the computer, it doesn't matter even if the virus can blow past your antivirus, because there are ways attackers can defeat antivirus. So if you have that program running in your computer, that program cannot run if that program is not on the list of approved programs. So we encourage people, don't approve ransomware. You know, none of that stuff can run if it's blocked. So that would be the first thing to do, is called application whitelisting. And very, very few people use that. What we find is a lot of executives have never heard of it before. We find a lot of IT professionals have never heard of it before. And even when an IT professional does hear of it, they're too busy to implement application whitelisting. There's a little trick you can tell your IT professionals that most of them, no one's ever told them. You can set up application whitelisting, and it's like a car. It has a transmission. There are two gears, neutral and drive. So your IT pro can set up application whitelisting, but leave the transmission in neutral. And what that means is, programs will all still be allowed to run as they always were in the past. However, the IT professional will see a list of what would have been blocked. So that gives the IT professional time to go in there and make sure those blocked programs indeed should have been blocked. Then once everything feels good, IT can shift the application whitelisting into drive and ought to be transparent to users, because all the programs are approved to run are the programs they use all day long anyway. And now if a virus tries to get on a computer, the virus will be blocked. But let's suppose the HR department only runs a program once a year and they need to run that, and it doesn't work because it's not been whitelisted. So they call down to the IT department and say, hey, fix it. The first thing IT should do is take application whitelisting's transmission and move it from drive to neutral. And then the program will just start running. IT goes in and sees a red X by the name of that program, changes it to a green check mark, shift back into drive, and everything's fine. So that's kind of a rapid explanation of why IT professionals don't set that up. They don't have time, and frequently they're not aware of being able to put application whitelisting in neutral,
right,
to make sure everything is working properly. The second thing that needs to be done is limit your users, restrict your users for what they're able to do. Because if that user has an attacker, infect that user's computer, the attacker can only do what the user can do. A very easy to understand example is you don't want users to have permissions to install software. In other words, the computer will not function in the install software mode. It'll just say, can't do that. That means if an attacker gains control of that computer, the attacker cannot install programs because the user can't install programs. And there are a lot of other things that need to be restricted as well. It gets pretty complicated, but that's the second thing is restrict your users. They can't do much. That means the attacker can't do much.
Let me ask real quick.
Sure.
Is an example of that maybe if a user is allowed to install iTunes, they probably shouldn't be. There should be some restricted access because if they can just install whatever they want, it means that an attacker can install whatever he or she wants.
That's right. Good job. That's exactly what I'm glad your listeners are going to understand, because a whole lot of networks get infected that way. Now, there may be some software on your system that requires users to be able to install stuff in order for updates to function on the system, but that's a problem with the application itself, not with application whitelisting. It's a problem in the program. And unfortunately, there are a few programs out there, very unfortunate, that require users to have the ability to install software or the program can't apply its own updates.
So that was number two. Mm-hmm. And then what's number three?
Number three is to keep something called security patches up to date. There's some important things to know about security patches. One of the things is they're extremely difficult to get set up because the security patch, it seals known holes in operating systems such as OS X on the Mac and Windows. If there is a hole that attackers are using to infiltrate those computers, Microsoft or Apple, they become aware of that hole. They seal the hole in the form of delivering a patch, also known as an update to people's computers, which seals the hole. That all looks great. The problem is, though, patches sometimes break computers. So everything's working fine on your computer. A critical security patch comes out. You got to have it. You put it on your computer, and all of a sudden your computer breaks. So that's no fun. So at the office, that's where you're going to have a lot of backups, and at home, too. And there are really three steps people need to use when they install patches at the office. The first tip is the patches have to be tested. Now, some of your listeners may have large companies, 50, 100, 100,000 computers. In that case, you're going to want to have a separate QA environment where everything gets tested. So it's not on a production environment, but it's on a quality assurance environment that you can practice tests on. Now, small companies, smaller, their QA environment may be Jimmy's computer over in the corner. And they'd install stuff there and see what breaks, because at least it's only breaking Jimmy's computer. Then the second thing that needs to happen during the patch installation is after you install it, preferably in the QA environment, you practice uninstalling the patch. That way, if the patch gets deployed out into the production environment and breaks things, at least IT knows what to do to remove the patch. It's not trying to scramble around and figure it out. And the third thing that needs to be done is when the patch is deployed inside the organization, the patch needs to undergo what we term a staged rollout, meaning that the patch first gets put on just a few computers. If they're okay, then put the patches on 10 computers, then 50, then 100, then all the rest. You get to decide. It'd be something an executive needs to make that decision, not IT. IT is very reluctant to install patches because they don't want to break things. So you need to have that conversation. Microsoft generally releases their patches on the second Tuesday of every month. They release other patches too, but the second Tuesday of every month is known as Patch Tuesday. Then Wednesday is known as Disassembly Wednesday. That's when the attackers take apart the patches to see what the patch fixed. And Thursday is called Exploit Thursday. That's when the attackers now know where the holes are and they can attack those holes for everybody who's not put the patches on their system yet. So that pretty much gives you a 48-hour window to get the patches installed. However, most organizations take longer than that. One of the strategies we're seeing a lot of our customers use that on the outside it looks like a bad idea, but when you really think about it, it can be good, and that is they leave their workstations set to automatic update, just like they would do at home. So as soon as Microsoft releases a patch, the patch gets installed on the workstation. The danger there is if that patch that gets automatically installed breaks something on the computer, all the computers get broken right away, which can create a nightmare for IT. So IT generally doesn't want to use the automatic patching. They would prefer to have control over the patches, But the problem with that is IT's so busy doing everything else, often it means the patches don't get on quickly enough. And servers, of course, you always make sure those are installed manually. But the official recommendation is install patches and have control over them. Don't let your computers automatically update. However, we find in companies that we audit that are using the automatic updates in the workstations, their updates are in just a lot better shape. Something else to know about patches that is almost always overlooked is Microsoft patches are great. Apple patches are great. They're pretty straightforward to install, whether it's automatic using tools from Microsoft or even third-party tools that'll help with that. The problem comes into this thing called Flash. It's difficult to get patched. Something called Java. It's difficult to get patched. Other programs on your system. And all we care about are the patches that are defined by you filter them down to critical security patches. If it's a recommended patch, forget it. If it's a patch that just changes functionality, unless you need that functionality, forget it. In other words, there are just too many patches. You have to find a way to narrow it down. I'd love it if people start applying those other kind of patches too, but you're so busy. Just focus on critical security. So people have to really include it along with the operating system. There are three other things they need to patch. One of them is Flash. Another is Java. And the third one is what's called a browser, simply meaning Safari, Firefox, Internet Explorer, Edge, Chrome. Those are the ways attackers are going to shoot for coming in, especially if a user clicks a link in an email message. See, that traffic goes out to a website, which might be called we'regonnahoseyounow.com. Even though the user doesn't know that's the website they're going to. But that information comes back from the malicious website. What it hits is the user's browser, because the browser is trying to open a web page, if you will. Mm-hmm. So Flash, Java, and the browser are essential to have patched, in addition to the operating system. So those are just the things about patches. It's a real long topic, but these are some of the things that your listeners, they'll benefit very much from being aware of.
So we've talked about in-company activities. Now we're going to think kind of out of company. So many people use third-party service providers for so many things. The bigger the company, probably the more providers. What questions can you ask yourself and your third-party service providers about being more secure, and what steps can you take based on the answers to those questions?
That's a really good question. I'm glad you're aware of that. We're finding that almost half of the breaches that we go in and see were caused by some third party, not the company itself. It could be a situation like Target is a great example. Target did not have a security breach themselves. It all started with a HVAC, or heating, ventilation, air conditioning company, HVAC, that did all the billing, and they're outside of Pittsburgh. That company had the passwords to get into Target's network, and the attackers got through the passwords, and that's how the attackers got in. However, all of those heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems were isolated. They were not connected to Target's main network. So the fact that the attackers got into the heating and air conditioning units was not that big a deal. I mean, it could be akin to some offices have their office computers on an office wireless network. Then they provide a secondary network for guests. And they've been told by their IT professionals, which basically is right, that the guest network is outside of the firewall. So guests cannot come back into the company, while the wireless inside is just for your users to be able to get work done. Well, Target did that too. They had the HVAC units outside of the Target network. However, common, you can count on a habit of attackers. We even do that too as penetration testers. Once you get a toehold anywhere, you immediately try to dig deeper. And the attackers were able to dig deeper. They got from the HVAC units into Target's point of sale system, and the rest is highly documented history. So that third party needed to have been more secure. And I happen to know they've taken a lot of steps to be more secure, but it was very expensive for the third party. Lots of times third parties won't go to that much trouble. A lot of our clients will send us out to their third parties to audit them. So that's something else your listeners could do. It would be to hire an auditor to go out to the third party and see what are going on. Some of the things we see, just to give an update, number one, the patches frequently are not up to date at all. If the third party uses a managed service provider, the managed service provider is not incentivized to keep the patches up to date in any company, because they don't want patches breaking stuff. It just adds to the workload of the managed service provider, and the managed service provider cares about their customers. The managed service provider does not want to break their customers' networks. So therefore, the managed service providers don't apply the patches. But that's very risky on the company side because you need the patches. Hence the three things you go through that we talked about earlier to make sure your patches are okay. Test them first in a similar environment. Be sure there's a staged deployment. And also have practiced ahead of time how to delete the patches if you need to delete them. But that's important. There are a lot of physical security controls that need to happen. Obviously, if an attacker gets hold of a computer, the attacker can take control of that computer. So sometimes third parties have very weak security, and cameras do not increase security. They just let the third party go back and see what happened. They need to have deadbolt locks on doors. Wherever the computer is stored, it needs to be very, very secure. Because if an attacker gets into the third-party systems, even if it's an employee at the third-party company goes in and they take control over the third-party network, then the attackers use that to get into your listener's network, and we don't want that to happen.
Well, certainly, plenty of companies have the risks of Target, but plenty are also smaller and maybe in different businesses, maybe don't have as much point-of-sale information available. So how should a company think about an IT security budget?
Yeah, it's a great question. We see companies at both ends of the spectrum. One company may be a lawn and garden shop, and all they do is sell rakes and flowers and seeds, which is awesome. Spend a lot of time at those kind of places. But like you said, they don't at least believe they have much to protect. However, at the other end of the spectrum would be hospitals or some kind of healthcare entity, because now not only they have everybody's identifying information, they've also got their protected health information too, such that if attackers can gain access to protected health information, they can do things like getting prescriptions, under someone else's name. They could also collect life insurance if they can make that person look like they're dead on paper. There are all kinds of things attackers can do once they have protected health information. So those people have the biggest risk, the biggest exposure, if you will. Going back to lawn and garden, the main thing they need to be concerned about, well, there are two things. Two of the things they should be concerned about. Number one would be an attacker using their systems to launch attacks against some other company. So if an attacker uses lawn and garden company's computer to go attack the FBI or something, the FBI obviously is going to come back to the lawn and garden company and hold them suspect. The other thing lawn and garden or any other company needs to be worried about would be attackers storing stolen information or illegal content on the small network. For example, when attackers steal a bunch of credit cards or protected health information or anything like that, the attackers do not want that data to be stored on the attacker's computers. It'd be evidence. So the attackers will use remote devices to store information, and therefore your lawn and garden company would be in a lot of trouble. Something lawn and garden company would not be in trouble for, but it really contributes to hackers, and something that victims would appreciate is there's something called a denial of service attack, distributed denial of service attack, and that's where attackers will have little programs that are installed on lots of computers around the world. And if someone gets really angry at company XYZ, the attackers can command all these computers to send little spurts of data at company XYZ. And of course, company XYZ is overwhelmed with all this data coming in. That can happen sometimes at small companies. And it's not going to affect the small company, but you sure don't want to be on the receiving end of all those computers. So I think the point is, when you're looking at a budget to decide how much money to invest in being secure, you really need to think, what are the risks to you? And if a company feels they won't have anything to lose, no one to steal the data, there's still risks associated with that. And they just need to think about the reputation, how bad that would be hurt if they had to announce they had a breach, and so on.
That was part one of an interview with cybersecurity expert Mike Foster. Part two of the interview, which focuses on personal device safety, is coming soon on the J of A podcast. For more podcasts, find us on journalofaccountancy.com/podcast, Podomatic, iTunes, and other podcast platforms. I'm Senior Editor Neil Amato. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.